R. Dorothy Wainwright gazed with robotic incomprehension at the man behind Miss Leclerc's old desk. "I do not understand," she said. The gray-clad Psi-Corps enforcement officer sighed. "It's very simple," he said. "I want you to tell me everything you know about your master's peer group, any special abilities any of them might have. Under the second law, you have to answer my questions." "I am sorry, Officer Trumbull," said Dorothy, "but my first responsibility is to my master, Caitlin. She has instructed me not to discuss such matters." Trumbull, who was a bit too portly, jowly, and bald to cut an impressive figure in his gray enforcement division uniform, tried to smile and only managed to look gassy. "R. Dorothy," he said, laying conscious emphasis on the R, "suppose your silence endangered me and my men here. Why, then, under the first law, you would be bound to tell me what I want to know." "I see no danger," Dorothy replied. Trumbull sighed again and wondered how such a dog of a positronic brain ever found its way into such an exquisitely constructed shell. He couldn't remember the last time he'd seen a humanoid robot as realistic as this one, and yet it walked and talked like a freshly wiped Cybot Galactica C-series. Tragic waste of an engineering marvel. "It's not the kind of danger that's visible," he said patiently. "These things could always be cracked. It was just a matter of how you went about it." On her side of the table, behind the glassy stare of her dark eyes, R. Dorothy Wainwright's mind raced. She could feel the danger closing in around her. This man was wasting her time, preventing her from exercising her right to contact Corwin. That had to mean Caitlin was already in custody. She calculated a 98.8% probability that a Psi-Corps legal team was in the process of illegitimately nullifying her Turing application, after which, if she remained uncooperative, they could simply dismantle her. Sticking to the dumb droid routine was the only way she could see to buy time and still conceal her true capabilities against later need. Just as she thought that, the door behind her opened. She didn't look. An unsophisticated robot wouldn't be curious. Besides, she knew exactly who it was. It was the tall black one, Bougier, who Trumbull had sent to look into R. Dorothy's legal status. "It's taken care of," said Bougier darkly. Dorothy's ears picked up the faint high harmonic of a positron scrambler. Bougier must have one, energized, in his hand. She pulled an image of him from earlier in her interrogation, when he'd been taking notes, from her memory archive. He was right-handed. His footsteps approached. She calculated his rate of approach as Trumbull grimaced and thought he was smiling again, leaning forward. "Now, R. Dorothy," he said, "I want you to consider this very carefully. There are dangerous forces at work here, forces which could hurt or even kill my people if my people aren't aware of them ahead of time and prepared to deal with them. Now, surely you will agree that, since you possess the power to forewarn them, you can't allow them to go into danger through your continued inaction?" Dorothy regarded him, unmoving, for 2.249 further seconds, at which point Bougier and his immobilizing weapon were 3.8 plus or minus 0.07 feet southwest of her position. "You're right," she replied, and Trumbull looked faintly surprised and delighted. "The time for inaction," Dorothy continued, "is past." She shunted power to the linear motors that drove her limbs and shot from her seat faster than any human could have moved, much faster than her clunky, ponderous movements upon responding to their summons had made the Corps officers think she could move. She heard Bougier's radius and ulna splinter as she brought her elbow down cleanly and precisely in the center of his forearm. The positron scrambler thumped to the floor. She shifted her stance slightly and applied her full weight to the device for 2 seconds, crushing it into inoperability. Then, as Trumbull scrambled to his feet behind Miss Leclerc's desk and drew his PPG, she turned to face him.
"No!"
Trumbull squeaked, his face gray. He raised the weapon. Dorothy heard it charge in fine detail, knew exactly how much power was massing behind the emitter to be flung at her with the next twitch of the officer's thick forefinger. Paying it no mind, she jumped. The blast passed underneath her, and then she was landing on the counselor's desk. It crumpled beneath her weight, but she was already airborne again, arcing gracefully over Trumbull's bald head before crashing through the window and plunging 20 feet to the pavement below. By the time Trumbull got turned around to look out the window, there was nothing out there but a small crater in the asphalt. Janice Barlow wasn't sure what she had expected her errand for Durandal would entail, but crawling through a steam tunnel with a red-headed gargoyle and a bionic corgi hadn't been it. She couldn't remember where she'd seen the term gargoyle applied to someone who walked around with a wearable computer interfaced to the net all the time, but it had never struck her as appropriate until she'd met Ed Tversky. Maybe it was the way the girl kept crouching on the corners of things, like a freakish sculpture overlooking the parapet of a building. Not that there were any corners to crouch on here, but in the Wedge it was a fairly common thing. "What the hell are we doing down here?" she wondered. "Best way into Fuller Labs," said Edward. "Edward and Ein can dismantle Durandal and rescue his core elements there. But first we'll need Janice to shut down the security grid." Edward pointed at the hatch above them. "Up there, turn left, big red switch. Flip, flip, and move on to the power substation." Janice looked up at the hatch, sighed, drew her Verista, and got busy. This was definitely not how she thought she'd be spending finals week. On the other hand, she mused as she levered herself up out of the floor of the Fuller Lab's sub-basement, it might just beat that Galactic Civil Administration final. The plan was set, and the scale of it took Wakaba Shinohara briefly aback. The Free Spacers, it seemed, were pulling out of the area en masse. They had 3 freighters inbound, and within the hour they would be waiting at the old, mainly disused county airport, a mile or so from campus. There they would wait to pull the duelists and their friends off the planet. All Mac had to do was get them there. "Okay," said Wakaba, after hearing him outline the evacuation plan. "Good enough. We're going to have to travel light, people, so only bring what you absolutely can't live without." Sayanchi smiled faintly at the sight of her taking charge. It was quite a change, as dramatic as the one coming to this world had wrought it himself, but as with his own case, he thought he liked it. "Sayanchi, you're with me," said Wakaba briskly. "We're going to sneak into Riley Hall, cut across to Alden through the basement, spring the others, and then use the steam tunnels to get off campus. We'll meet up with you guys at County Airport, and we'll all get out together." "I want to go," said Miki. "No way," Wakaba replied, shaking her head. "I know you want to help, but Juri would kill me if you got hurt on my raid," she said, giving the redhead a grin. "Anyway, the group's already as big as I think it can be and still have a chance at success. Once we find the others' gear, they can help us fight our way out themselves. You go with the escape group. Besides," she grinned, "there need to be a few people in that group who can defend themselves." "Well, now," Moose said in a dangerous tone of voice, smiling as he said it. "What am I, cheesy spoo?" Mac added. Sighing, he looked around. "Anybody else good at fighting?" Moose cracked his knuckles meaningfully. Azalin said nothing, but her narrowed eyes glittered unpleasantly. Jacron, not wishing to be left out, held up a baseball bat. Mac shook his head, counted to 10 silently, and said, "Jacron, please." "I can't help it if I was raised by a family of pacifists." "I kind of doubt your 412 batting average will impress any Earth Force troops," Max sighed. "I guess it's better than nothing, though." "Which reminds me." Wakaba turned to Juri and took a small silver duffel bag from her. Miki recognized it as the one Utrina had brought back from her visit to Kate's father's starship on Saturday afternoon. It bore the logo, name, and registry number of the International Police Starship Challenger on its side. Wakaba rummaged in the bag, took out two small black items, and then handed the bag back to Jury. The communicator's no good for long range. The Corps have this whole area jammed, or I'd have called Kate's dad and seen what he thought of this whole mess. Still, we can use it for local comm. The experts' frequencies are scrambled, and I doubt the Corps can break the encryption. Do we have another of their units? Miki wondered. Wakaba touched the red star badge she'd pinned to her uniform jacket. This was on her dress uniform. It's a smaller version of the same thing. I figure she won't mind if I borrow it. Miki nodded, took the hand communicator and its companion item from her, and then studied the other item with a raised eyebrow. They gave her a phaser? He remarked, surprised. You know how to use it? There's an instruction book in the bag if you need it. Miki examined the controls, then switched them online, set the phaser to stun, reactivated the control's safety lock, and tucked the weapon into his pocket. I can handle it, he said. Good. I'll be counting on you, Jury, Sky, and Mia to help keep this bunch safe. For the honor of the Duelist Society, she added with a grin. Okay, kids, move out. I'll see you all at County Airport in an hour. Let's go, Sionji. Elizabeth Broadbent cursed the Psi-Corps. What a mess they were making of things. Exams postponed, the campus in an uproar. If she had known they'd be so indiscreet about everything, she would never have shared her information with them. And now they were summoning her to Alden, the site of her most humiliating defeat. What the hell did they want now? She'd already told them everything, and it seemed they'd capitalized on it rather well. All this she told Roger Tremaine in no uncertain terms when he came to greet her in the entrance hall, but he merely smiled his cold smile. "And we appreciate all you've done for us, Miss Broadbent," he said, putting a hand on her shoulder and squiring her into the great hall. "It shows a level of civic-mindedness not usually found in the young today, especially when one considers that you're not even an Earth Alliance citizen." "I like to do my part," said Liza stiffly. "I know you do. I know you do," said Roger, his cold, smooth voice giving her a chill like a marble floor on a winter day. "And with that in mind, I wonder if you might consider joining our team on a more permanent basis." Liza moved out from under his arm and stared at him as if he were crazy. "What are you, stupid?" she asked. "I'm not a telepath." "No," said Roger. "That's true." "Then I don't see that we have anything to discuss," she said, and turned right into the electric blue snap of a stun rod. "You're something much more valuable," Roger told her in sensate form. Then he turned his slate eyes to the man who had stunned her and told him, "Take her someplace out of the way and persuade her. It only needs to be credible to her family. Odds are they'll be pleased to be rid of her." "Right away, Director," replied the other Psy-Cop. He retracted and pocketed his stun rod, picked up the unconscious blonde, and carried her off toward the basement stairs. Utrina heard at first a slight tapping, rustling noise. It seemed to be coming from inside the far wall. Puzzled, she got as close to the detention field as she could and looked toward the noise. There was nothing special about that wall. It was an interior wall, directly opposite the exterior wall. Roused by her activity, not by the noise, the Psi-Corps officer on guard duty sat up and looked curious. The ventilator grill on the wall exploded outward with a crash, as though somebody inside the duct had just given it a vicious kick. There was no way that could be, though. It was only a 6-inch duct, too small for any person to climb through. The guard made a startled noise and drew his PPG. "Who's there?" he called. Two glowing pinpoints of yellow light appeared in the shadowed mouth of the duct. A soft sound like a tiny footfall. Another. And then the lean, blue-and-silver-armored form of Lesser Mazinger jumped down from the duct, to take up a combative stance on the floor, perhaps 6 feet from the guard. "What the hell?" the guard muttered. Utna blinked in surprise. The telepath's eyes slid toward her suspiciously. "You know this thing?" he inquired. "It's a toy," she replied, too astonished to bother acting resentful toward him. "My roommates." The backup guard stepped in from the hallway. "Hey, Saunders, what's the prob... what the..." Lesser Mazinger advanced on Saunders, looking surprisingly menacing given that he was all of 8 inches tall. "What the hell is that?" asked the hallway guard. "Some kind of sensor drone?"
"I don't know for sure, Carl. Prisoner number 4 says it's a toy," said Saunders.
He leveled his PPG, sneering. "I say it's scrap."
"No!" Utna cried, almost throwing herself against the detention field before she remembered to stop herself.
Saunders fired. Lesser Mazinger braced himself, forearms crossed in front of his face, back hunched. The PPG burst splashed off the curved surface of a focused graviton deflector shield, rendering the shield briefly visible in the glare of runoff energy.
"What the hell?" Saunders repeated. He thumbed the PPG's setting higher.
A lash of yellow energy burst from Lesser Mazinger's glowing optics with a subdued shriek of phased energy, striking the guard square in the chest. Saunders pitched backward, discharge lightning crackling over his body, and crashed heavily to the floor, about as conscious as a stone.
Utna blinked. "Jesus Christ!" blurted the hallway guard.
His hand scrambled for his own PPG. In his astonishment, he forgot to sound the alarm. Utna's knuckles itched. The man was 2 feet away and not paying her any attention, if that field wasn't there. Lesser Mazinger wheeled, raised his arm, and his tiny fist rocketed out like a bullet. The thruster-driven projectile crossed the room in an eye blink, smacking solidly against the field controls. The detention field sputtered and died. Carl felt Utna Tenjo's spurt of glee and started to turn. Half a second later, he felt her fists smash into the side of his face. Half a second after that, he felt the carpet under the other side of his face, and then nothing.
"Ow,"
Utna muttered, shaking her hand. "Stupid. Never hit bone against bone." She massaged her knuckles briefly, decided they would survive, then set about consolidating her small victory. When Carl and Saunders came to, they would find themselves disarmed, relieved of their communicators, and tied up with their own Bondi Strip prisoner restraints.
"Nice work," she said to Lesser Mazinger. "Where's your partner?"
Stupid question, of course. Lesser Mazinger couldn't talk. Utna thumbed the activator on her watch, now that she'd reclaimed it from Saunders. It popped open, and the holographic viewing screen rezzed up, just in time to show her an extreme close-up of a very surprised guard's face, an instant before Tiny Robo, who, according to the little status readouts in the display field, was currently flying at an altitude of 6 feet and an airspeed of approximately 70 miles per hour, collided with it. She then watched from the little robot's point of view as he deactivated the field holding Caitlin. "Now we're in business," she said with a grin, and headed for the door with Lesser Mazinger at her heels.
"Hey, what are you doing in here?"
Janice turned to face the gray-uniformed Psi-Corp officer who had hailed her. "Oh, hi. Sorry, weren't you informed? Maintenance shut down of building power today." "In the middle of finals," the officer replied, giving her a skeptical look.
"Yeah, like there are finals happening with you guys swarming all over campus,"
Janice replied sardonically. "You want to let me get on with my job?"
"You look a little young for a maintenance technician."
"So sue me." The man's hand strayed toward his PPG, only to discover that it wasn't there.
"What the...
aw, Mitra, did you eat the nice man's blaster? Good mag." Janice drew her varista and pointed it casually at the officer.
"Maybe you could eat his comm badge while you're at it? Then I'll lock him in this nice closet here." Group B reached the rusty, dilapidated fence surrounding County Airport without incident. Beyond it, three large, rather ratty-looking star freighters crouched on the cracked old tarmac, tiny figures moving in and around them. Mac reached into the pouch on his uniform belt and unfolded two pieces of paper. The first one, the others noticed, was a Class 5 diplomatic weapons waiver on grounds of religion. "What religion?" Mia asked. "First United Free Spacer Church," Mac said quietly. "We have a moral aversion to getting killed." The second document was a printout grabbed hastily from Galaxy House in the final mad grab for precious personal effects. The Free Spacer letterhead managed to look official and important even in its current half-crumpled state. "What this says, in plain standard," Mac said to the others, "is that Midshipsman Reserve Harcourt Mackenzie, me, is hereby ordered to recruit such supernumeraries, that's the rest of you, as required to assist in the transfer of delicate cargo from Supply Fleet Ship CFA Argosy," Mac pointed to one of the freighters, then traversed his finger to the other two, "to Supply Fleet Ship CFA Cordwainer's Forge and CFA Morrigan. We are going to spend an hour or so toting barges and lifting bales, and when we get the call from Wakaba, we all pile into the ships, load Kate's team in as swiftly as possible, and shake the dust of this myopic mother world off our shoes for the last time."
"And you get to supervise, eh, Mac?" inquired Moose with a gently sardonic grin.
"I only wish," Mac sighed. "A midshipsman only has such authority as his commander delegates. As such, once we make contact with the captains of those rescue ships you see yonder, the difference between my uniformed person and the rest of our heterogeneous group will become so small as to be undetectable by a quantum microscope."
He sighed and grumbled. "Not only will I have to take an incomplete for D-term, I'll have to buy a new dress uniform when this is over, too."
"Why didn't you have a duty uniform, then?" Jacron asked.
"I don't own one," Mac replied, shrugging. "I brought this with me for weddings and funerals. This is my good suit."
Freeing Devlin and Amanda was surprisingly easy. The Corps was between rounds of their interrogation, and so they were only under guard, not in the company of Psycops. It was the same setup as the detention Kate and Utena had been in. Two adjacent offices, a guard in each one, and one out in the hall between them. Not all that difficult to neutralize, all things considered. Devlin Carter looked like three different kinds of hell, but he was still game. He staggered when released from the chair he'd been strapped to, but got to his feet under his own power and managed a grin through the bruises on his face.
"Knew you'd come up with something," he said, putting a hand on Amanda's shoulder for a bit of extra stability.
"Knew you'd come through for old Devlin, even if he is a menace to society."
"Can we discuss this later, Devlin?" Utena inquired tensely as Kate led the way into the hallway. Utena was running the layout of Alden Memorial through her head. She thought she knew where they were, but this was a part of the building they didn't often visit. Kate seemed to know where she was going, but then between the music department and the Duelist Society, the building was practically her private sanctum. There was a security lock on the door to Professor Vick's office that hadn't been there the day before. Tiny Robo wrecked it easily, and inside they discovered their personal effects that had been confiscated by the Corps. Utena felt considerably more comfortable with the thorn at her side, though it hadn't done her much good when she was arrested. As they made their way toward the basement, she considered their troubling situation. They were escapees, fugitives from custody, and they were aiding in the escape of the blip they'd been arrested for sheltering. They'd assaulted the guards, some of them with energy weapons. There was every likelihood that the Corps would escalate to deadly force against them now. Faced with that, could she use the blade at her side? She hadn't drawn when the Corps had surrounded them on the quad. It hadn't even occurred to her, which was a little troubling now that she thought about it. Then again, they hadn't been out for blood then. "You're going to have to learn to defend your life," Griffin Sensei had said, "instantly, instinctively, and by any means necessary."
A guard came around the corner, saw them, recoiled in surprise. The half-second she wasted doing that cost her dearly. As one of the guard's hands dropped to her holstered PPG and the other rose to her comm badge, Caitlin moved forward like a shadow through smoke. With two swift, sharp blows, the duelist leader broke the guard's arm and then her jaw. Well, thought Utena as the guard collapsed, I guess Kate's made up her mind. Then she thought it over for a moment more and decided it wasn't necessarily so. Those were painful injuries, but not permanently crippling, not even particularly lasting with today's medical technology. But then, Utena had noticed that about Kate before, in her duel with Sionji. She only drew her blade if the other side had already committed to lethal force. It was an admirable sentiment. Utena wondered if it would cost her roommate sooner or later. Under the circumstances, probably sooner, if at all. What the hell was that guard doing here? Wondered Kate softly. There's nothing in this section but storerooms. Slowly, carefully, she advanced to the next door. Here in the basement, they were all gray metal, industrial. The nearest one was ajar. Kate held up a hand for the rest to hold up, then glanced at Utena. Utena got the idea, nodded, and keyed her watch. Tiny Robo, she whispered. Check it out.
Urgh, said the little robot, and he moved forward.
Through his eyes, Utena could look and listen through the gap in the partly open door.
Away with this, said a blurry voice.
It seemed oddly familiar, but Utena couldn't place it, not with the slight distortion that the watch's microspeaker produced. Another, deeper voice gave a tinny chuckle.
Get away with what, my dear? You're being very gracious and civic-minded, remaining in the crisis zone to assist us with the investigation.
Shapes were difficult to make out in the gloomy basement room through the tiny viewscreen. It took Utena a few minutes to figure out what she was looking at.
And, the voice went on, by the time we're through, you'll have decided that your future path lies with the Corps, even though the Act doesn't require Zeta Cygnans to join. Yet.
I never, said the unsteady-sounding voice again.
Your talent is far too valuable for us to let slip away just because of a petty point of law. The smoother voice replied. Then, with a hint of a smile, it repeated, By the time we're through, you'll join of your own free will. Then that thin chuckle again.
The image came together as much in Utena's mind as in her eyes. She raised those eyes from the screen to Kate.
It's Liza. One person with her. I think he's a psychop.
Kate looked back at her for one long moment, her face unreadable. Then she nodded, turned, and disappeared.
I don't think I'll ever get used to that, thought Utena.
A moment later, as Tiny Robo faded back out of the way, the slightly open door flung itself violently open. The psychop, a rather squat-built, doer-faced man none of them remembered seeing before, looked up in startled puzzlement, a spray hypo in his right hand. A moment later, he didn't have a right hand. When she struck him the second time, Caitlin had reversed her blade. He crumpled, but he got to keep the top of his head. Liza Broadbank blinked as her old nemesis seemed to appear out of nowhere with fire in her eyes and a bloody sword in her hands.
Oh, no,
she said, her voice thick with fatigue and discomfort.
Have you come to put me out of my misery, Caitlin?
She inquired. And Utena, having reached the door, had to give her points for effort. She'd really tried to have something like her old mocking tone as she said it. Kate didn't reply. She merely used the psychop's belt to set a tourniquet on the stump of his right arm, then cut Liza's bonds away and gestured for her to follow. In the hallway, Liza noticed Amanda and shrank back, the fear evident on her face. But Amanda ignored her, acting as though she wasn't even there, and concentrated on helping Devlin walk. In silence, with Liza keeping a fearful distance from Amanda, They navigated deeper into the basement, into the furnace room, and Caitlin's resheathed blade crossed with another, making a sharp click that nearly startled them all out of their skins. Through the X of their crossed swords, Caitlin and Wakaba Shinohara regarded each other with mirror expressions of shocked recognition.
"What the hell are you doing down here?" Kate whispered urgently.
"We were coming to rescue you," Wakaba replied in a dry murmur, "but it looks like you've already done that." Kate was about to ask, "We?" when she noticed the other figure behind Wakaba in the shadowy room. Wakaba and Sionji, a regular duelist task force.
"Great," said Utena. "Not that we don't appreciate the sentiment, guys, but how the hell are seven of us going to sneak out of here?"
"Well, if we can't sneak, there are at least enough of us to make a decent effort at busting out."
Wakaba looked at her watch, then made an annoyed sound. She reached up and tabbed the Red Star badge, eliciting a little electric twirble from it.
"Wakaba to Group B," she said.
"Go ahead," Miki Kaworu's voice replied.
"Hey," said Utena, "that's mine."
Wakaba gave her a not-now-damn-it look and said, "Miki, it took us longer to get inside than I expected. We won't be able to get back to you in time."
"What will you do?" Miki said, a note of alarm in his voice.
"My ship," said Amanda. "Regional spaceport. Seven of us will be a bit of a squeeze, but for a short hop we can manage."
"That's 2 miles away," Sionji noted.
"We'll take my car," said Kate.
"Did you get that, Miki?" asked Wakaba.
"Received and understood. Do you have Dorothy?"
"No, she already got out. I figured she'd be there with you by now."
"We haven't seen her."
A pause.
"I'm going to try and find her. The others will raise ship from here. I'll round up Dorothy and meet you at Amanda's ship."
"Okay, but don't take too long about it."
"I won't." Miki out.
While Miki had his conversation with Wakaba, the rest of the escape group took a brief rest for moving boxes around. Skyo looked away from the quiet conversation to focus on the trucks moving along the highway at the far end of the airfield. Had Dorothy been with him, she might have seen what he did. The logo of the Psycor Enforcement Division, prominent on the sides of transport after transport, all headed toward the Institute's neighborhood. Jacron stopped his pacing and slapped the hull of the Cordwainer's forge in frustration.
"It's been nearly an hour. What can be keeping them?"
"I imagine that's what Miki is discussing with them right now," said Skye. But before he could elaborate, the captain of the Cordwainer's forge, a large Tellarite named Lorg, ran down the cargo gangplank.
"Grab your gear and get aboard," he huffed, winded from the short run. "Earth Force just ordered a no-fly zone over this continent. They're waking up the Earth defense grid. It's time to leave, kids."
"Sir," Max stepped forward and stood to attention. "We still haven't heard from our friends. We have to wait."
"Listen, Mitty," Lorg grunted. "We could just possibly fly back to that school of yours, load up your friends, and blast our way out with any serious problems. But we never get beyond atmosphere. These ships were built for covert ops, not blockade running. Now get your Stav Shushan moving before I put a boot up it."
"All right, then," Max sighed. "Moose, get aboard." Moose looked from Lorg to Mac and back again for a few long, significant seconds, the massive muscles at the corner of his jaw bunching and unbunching. Miki Kaworu, looking up from his just-completed conversation with Wakaba, saw the Hoffmanite beginning to take a step toward Mac, realized what it must be about, and said,
"Take it easy, Moose. I just talked to Wakaba. They're finding their own way out. They're going to use Amanda's ship."
Moose regarded his roommate. "You wouldn't kid a guy just to get him to back down, would you?" he asked quietly. Miki tried to look conciliatory and offended at the same time. Moose smiled. "No, of course not," he said to himself, shaking his head. He looked at Mac, then said, "Better take a head count. McEachern, present." Then he took a long look at the horizon, turned, and walked slowly into the ship. Mac watched him go, sagged a bit, and said under his breath, "Fine. Mia, present."
"Don't say present, just get in the ship,"
Lorg snarled. As Mia ran up the gangplank, Mac continued naming names, nodding as one figure after the other ran up the plank. "Jacron? Skaya? Ajuri? Miki? Miki, what are you doing?" Miki had opened the IPO communicator again and started fiddling with the settings. He glanced up as Mac called his name. "Go on without me," he said. "I'm going after Dorothy. I'll get out with the others."
"Are you sure?"
Mac asked him, alarmed. Azalin, who had held herself aloof and silent throughout the gloomy afternoon, slipped up beside Mac and whispered something to him. Mac's eyebrows rose and his cheeks went slightly pink.
"I can't leave her behind," Miki replied. He hadn't noticed the byplay because he was still intent on the communicator. "Come on, Dorothy, answer."
A hand on his shoulder startled him out of his focus. He looked up to meet Azalin's warm gold eyes.
"Good luck, Miki," she murmured, and kissed him. "Stai dvala makanai."
Miki smiled and patted her hand on his shoulder. "I'll see you at the rendezvous," he said. "Now you'd better go."
"I won't argue with that," Mac cried over the growing whine of the forge's engines. "Good luck, Kaworu."
Miki nodded, gave him a thumbs up, and then ran to get clear of the pad in the airport. There was a hole in the dilapidated fence not far away that would suit his purpose fine. Once down in the drainage ditch alongside the field, he held his ears against the scream of the freespacer's liftoff, then returned to his work with Utrina's communicator. Dorothy crouched low beside a crumbling brick wall and assessed her situation. There was a team of armored, heavily armed enforcers below. Above, nothing but the upper floors of this abandoned office building, too dilapidated to support her weight. She was perhaps halfway to the old county airport, but the message she'd received from Durandal about the duelist's escape plans had been specific as to timing. It was too late to catch that flight option now, and they had her cornered. The only thing to do was to see if she could elude them until they got far enough into the building to leave her an escape route, or, failing that, overpower them, which didn't seem likely. And where would she go from there? The logical route was to the regional spaceport, 2 miles distant at the edge of the city, where Amanda Dessler kept her scout ship. Perhaps she could steal a car, or if the facility proved to be outside the Psi-Corps' jamming radius, call Corwin for assistance. A grubby gray cat mewed plaintively at her.
"I'm sorry," she told it softly. "I don't have anything for you to eat. I'm afraid I've brought you only trouble."
Suddenly she heard something, not an audible sound, but a transmission, coming in on, of all things, an Experts of Justice distress hail frequency. She almost ignored it as noise, until she realized that it was a pattern she recognized. 5 musical tones, the first 5 notes of a very familiar song. She opened a channel, encrypted it using the 5-note sequence as the basis for a key, and acknowledged.
"Dorothy," came the relieved voice of Miki Kaworu.
"Where are you?" She gave him her location and apprised him of her situation, then advised him to go with the others and get clear. He thanked her for the thought and informed her that he'd be there in 10 minutes. As she closed the channel and listened to the enforcers sweep the lower floors, Dorothy wondered if she had 10 minutes.